All right, it's on.
What? It's on?
Welcome to our world.
Well, I'm Jess.
And I'm Adam.
That's it. Hello?
Hello.
Oh, okay, great.
We are on. This is the next episode.
Yeah.
Not sure which number it is, but it's the next one.
Yeah, so with us tonight is Kate Chill. She is not only a member of my family, but has been for a long time and has a very interesting life that we thought would be really awesome to have here and learn a little bit more about her, and thought it'd be fun to listen to.
Yeah.
So, Kate, welcome.
Thanks. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm excited because we talked about this right before we, well, right when you came over. Everybody that we've had up to this point was either a friend from high school, somebody we work with. You were a little apprehensive slash nervous about when we had Brad Stone from Stone Strength on because you had never really met him before. You knew of him.
Yeah.
But you were excited to kind of get into it. And I told you when you got here, this is the most excited I've been because I don't know you. And I'm super excited to, like, be in the viewer seat, I think.
Yeah. With, you get to learn along with the audience.
I get to learn with everybody else. So I'm super pumped for you to be in our studio.
Your backyard.
Backyard. But yeah, thank you so much for coming. And thanks for bringing some sparkling sake and for bringing Jess that bottle
Memphis
of wine.
Memphis is here.
I'm going to handle that.
Awesome. Well, Kate, why don't you kick it off by just telling us a little bit about yourself and who you are and who's in your world?
Sure. So, I am married to Mike, who is Jess's cousin, and we have been together for a really long time. I think, I should know this. I think we've been together for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. I know that because I know I've spent more than half of my life with him.
Okay.
That was official sometime last year. we're married and we have two daughters, Caroline, who is 13, and Natalie, who's 11. We met in St. Louis and we're married here, but we moved to Charlotte for about 12 years and we've just been back in St. Louis for the last 3 years. And we're actually heading to Portland in 9 months. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Hold on. I have a quick question.
Sure.
Both of you originally from St. Louis? Did you say that?
We are. Yeah. Both of us are originally from St. Louis.
Okay. What is it like to be like a traveler of, like, here? I'm from St. Louis, born and raised. Like, everybody's, you're born here, you stay here. Very few people move here from other places, probably. But, like, what's it like being from St. Louis, born and raised, then going to North Carolina, now put, like, that's a big difference than, I assume, culturally from St. Louis.
It is a big difference. One of the things that we talked about, I think there's pros and cons of it. One of the things that we said that we really liked is that we moved there to North Carolina early in our marriage and right when we had kids. And so while it was a little bit more challenging to raise our children without the support of immediate family, it was also really interesting because I think it allowed us to create a greater bond. It's just an individual four-person family unit because we were really dependent on each other, and we had to kind of do everything on our own. But that said, once that foundation was laid, coming back here to St. Louis for the last couple of years has been great. So it's really nice for the kids, especially now that they're older and they can understand the experience, to be able to spend more time with their grandparents and their cousins and their aunts and uncles. So that's something we'll definitely miss when we move, but we like to come back here a lot, even when we're living out of state.
Awesome.
And it gives everybody an excuse to go to Portland.
Right, exactly.
If you'll have us.
Yes, there's an open invitation to anyone that wants to come.
Like to both podcast hosts?
To both podcast hosts.
I'd love to go to Portland again.
Yeah, for sure. So, Kate, you did a significant amount of travel when you were a kid. And, like, any...
I did.
Any stories you want to share or, like, experiences of how different the world is compared to St. Louis?
Sure. So one of the things I was thinking about before we started this podcast is just what I am passionate about. And one of the things I'm really passionate about is travel. So when I was younger, growing up, I spent 5 years living outside of the United States. I spent 3 years living in Cyprus, which is a small island in the Mediterranean Sea. And then I spent 2 years in boarding school in Switzerland. So those experiences during the time, and especially looking back on them, were really amazing experiences to have growing up. I think there's part of the time when I was in high school and boarding school where I was preoccupied on with the fact that I wasn't learning how to drive a car and ignoring the fact that I was in the middle of Europe and being able to travel on the weekends.
In Switzerland,
right. Yeah.
All the hot cocoa you can want.
Right? Yes, yeah, and yeah. And more, but yeah, it was a great experience, and I met so many people from a variety of different countries and nationalities, and being able to learn about different cultures and think about how different people can work together to get along, it was just really pivotal for me growing up. I loved living overseas a ton, and I wish it was something that we could do as a family, but just where our careers are, it never really, I don't think it realistically works out, but we try to take the kids overseas maybe every other year, mm-hmm. just so that they can get a little bit of a taste of what it's like to see things from a different perspective.
Sure. Do they enjoy it?
They do. They really enjoy it. Youngest isn't into the museums as much, but I think even just, it was funny, this is a small story, but when we took them to Europe a couple of years ago, and we tried to balance doing historical things with some fun kid things, and we took them to a water park in Rome, or outside of Rome, and while you think that, what are they going to learn at a water park, mm-hmm. it was really interesting. My oldest, after the day at the water park, said, "It's really interesting how people think about their bodies here in Europe. You can tell that people are just a lot less self-conscious and really, like, free with their bodies, and also not judgy of each other."
Oh,
and
wow.
So,
how old is your son? Or your daughter?
My daughter, at the time, she was 11 when she was...
Holy cow.
Yeah.
How, like... But, really observant.
She is actually super
an
observant.
11-year-old
yeah.
would say, like, "I notice social cues in a different country."
Yeah. That's but amazing. It is interesting to see that something as simple, I mean, you wouldn't think taking some of them to the water park would be an educational experience, but I actually think that they learned a lot from that. So,
yeah. That's awesome.
Really quick, what is boarding school like? Because I have this idea in my mind of what boarding school is like. Mm-hmm. I'm sure everyone has watched the movie Toy Soldiers with Sean Astin.
I haven't seen that, but now I want to.
You need to. It's in my top three. We discussed this in a previous episode.
Yeah.
It is the greatest movie ever made.
Okay.
But
Calm down.
Is what I think a boarding school is. Well,
we don't know what you think it is.
But is Lou Gossett Jr. the principal? Did it get taken over by terrorists, and did Sean Astin save it with a remote control airplane? Is how I picture boarding schools going. But what is a boarding? What is a boarding school?
Yeah, so it's not like that. But the reason I was there was because my parents, my dad was working in Saudi Arabia, and American teenagers weren't allowed to go to school in Saudi Arabia because we were considered a bad influence on the Saudi Arabian teenagers, which kind of makes sense.
Yep, makes total sense.
Makes total sense, and. It was way better to be in boarding school in Switzerland. So I was there for 2 years, and it was a ton of fun. I mean, it's really everything that you could think of as kind of like idealistic dream of what boarding school was like. You were with your friends all day long, so that was really fun. You know, obviously there was a school component. Felt like I was kind of always on the borderline of getting in trouble with things, so we came up with lots of ways to bend the rules and and try to get away with things. I think the most fun story that I have about doing something, which luckily we didn't get caught, was one day we were really bored, and my friend Michelle and I, and I think there was one other person, we decided it would be fun to sneak out of her third story window by tying sheets together.
No way.
We could have actually...
So it's exactly like Toy Soldiers with John Astin and Lou Gossett Jr. Okay. That's all I needed to know.
Yeah. No. We could have walked down the stairs to sneak out, but we thought that would be boring. So we figured out how to tie the sheets together, which is actually... It had to involve duct tape because they get really thick in the middle when you're trying to, like, slide down the rope. So we got all that together. We snuck out. And the only problem with sneaking out and boarding school was once you were out, then you had to stay out until 6 in the morning. Otherwise, you risk getting caught on the way back in.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Interesting.
So what's Cyprus like?
Cyprus? I was there when I was fairly young. So I was there from when I was 5 to when I was 8. But it was amazing because at the time that we went, it was really – there wasn't – a lot of technology in the country, and the country hadn't evolved a ton, so there were no fast food restaurants. We were on the list for a phone, and it took us 6 months to get a phone as a family when we were there.
A landline phone?
A landline phone, yeah.
That's
so
amazing.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't kill for a landline phone these days?
Exactly. But it was, I don't know what the right word is. It's not primitive because it was very socially advanced, but it was without all of the distractions, I guess, of even, you know, what life was like 20 years ago, we spent so much more time outside and just doing things with lots of other people. There was a huge expat community there, so it was a big social component because there wasn't a lot of other things to do.
Sure.
Yeah.
So what did your dad do for work, since it sounds like that was the reason you were in other countries?
Yes. So he was a consultant for a large consulting company. But all of the times that we moved, it was their choice. They just really liked kind of the adventure of living overseas and wanted to experience new cultures and ideas. So,
did you have siblings at that point?
I did. Okay. So, yeah, I have a younger brother and sister. My youngest sister is 7 years younger than me, and she was born in Cyprus.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and then they were both. They actually, though, went to school in Saudi Arabia. They didn't go to boarding school.
Really?
Because they weren't old enough.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. They weren't the bad influence.
They weren't. Not yet.
It's just you.
That's interesting.
Okay. That's amazing.
All right. Well, if we switch gears a little bit, you know, what do you do now? What did you do for work when you were working? And what are you passionate about besides travel?
So, for a long time, up until about 3 years ago, I worked full-time, and I worked for the majority of my career for a startup company in Charlotte called Red Ventures. And when I started at Red Ventures, it was 90 people in a strip mall, and when I left, it was 3,000 on a multi-acre campus. So it was a really exciting company to work for. There was huge growth while I was there, and my job there was a lot of fun. Towards the end of, I think right around 2015, both my husband and I, our jobs were both getting really busy, and we started to realize that it was challenging for us to both be working full times in the job that we were doing at the same time. And so we started to think about how we might be able to do something differently. And that's the time where I really started to get interested in real estate. So looking at how we could invest money in real estate to start helping primarily for retirement, so that we might take a little bit of the pressure off of earning and saving in the short term. And so we spent like 2015 and 2016 really spending time looking at real estate and purchasing some properties in order to for investment purposes.
Sure.
And so now I run those properties or help manage those properties. And then I also am home taking care of the kids in the house. And then I also volunteer part-time.
Okay.
What do you do volunteer-wise?
I volunteer for an organization called Wings of Hope. And so they're focused on using aviation to help improve lives. Primarily in the U.S., they do medical transport on small aircraft with volunteer pilots. And then they also have a focus internationally where they focus more on dropping medical supplies into remote areas or potentially bringing people out of remote areas for surgeries or medical procedures that they might need.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So that That's is crazy. That a St. Louis based?
It is a St. Louis based charity. It's out at the Chesterfield, the Spirit of St. Louis Airport. Yeah, it's a really great organization. I think they have over 270 active volunteers.
Wow!
So the organization is primarily run based on volunteers. I think it's 270 volunteers and 15 full time employees.
Wow!
Yeah,
awesome.
That's really interesting.
How does one get in touch with them if they wanted to, like if
involved,
it strikes them like, oh, that sounds cool.
Yeah, they if you just go to the website, there's places on the website where you can submit information about being interested in volunteer, but they have a whole volunteer recruiting committee that does a lot to find out if people are interested and also works with people to figure out if it would be a good match. So they're always looking for volunteers.
What kind of things do you do for them when you volunteer?
Specifically, mostly I work on grant writing.
Okay.
So, yeah, and so that's been interesting for me because I didn't have really much experience in the nonprofit side before this volunteer experience. And so grant writing is something that I've really had to learn from scratch, but I love to learn new things, and I think it's like anything, it's not as hard as I thought it might be when I initially
you do it enough
yeah, you can start to figure out it's not as intimidating as what I initially thought, but it's a lot of fun and it's great to spend the time submitting grants to help drive funds towards the organization.
Very cool. Awesome. So you touched on the investment side. What's your strategy when you invest? Do you flip, do you hold, what kind of properties do you look for, that kind of thing?
Sure. So we're pretty conservative on the investment side. The area that we lived in Charlotte, we felt like had a lot of opportunity for appreciation and growth when we looked at the housing prices there versus what we'd seen in other areas of the country. So we're really looking at buying properties and holding them for a significant period of time while they appreciate.
Okay.
We are primarily focused on single-family houses because on the appreciation side, it's just our feeling that they appreciate a little bit higher. But we generally go for the single-family houses that are on the lower end of the market and what's available. And so far, it's like I said, it's worked out really well. It's like anything, it's a little bit more time-consuming than I think we initially expected, and has required a little bit more money in terms of maintenance and upkeep on the properties than we expected. But they are still really good from an investment standpoint, and the appreciation in that area has helped a ton.
Nice.
With that. Yeah.
Okay. Do you have a property manager, I assume, since you don't live there?
We do, and I think we're on our third property manager.
So it's going well.
I've heard that's a common theme.
Yeah. So, but I'm hoping that this is the magic third time is a charm, what they say. So I think that's just one thing that you have to be flexible with. Some of the issues that we've run into with property managers are where they start out small and they actually have the time and attention to focus on individual properties, but as they scale and grow rapidly, especially in the market that we're in, in Charlotte, there's a ton of investment property activity. As those property managers scale, they don't bring on the necessary staff to support the growth in their business, and so the service level goes down. I think that's the main issue that we've had to address, and so it's just trying to find a company that can scale appropriately. So
sure.
Hopefully we're there.
Give me some consistency.
Yeah.
How many doors do you have?
So we have 8.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And they're all in Charlotte?
So we have 4 in Charlotte, and then we also have 4 in an area outside of Charleston, South Carolina, called Somerville.
Okay.
Very
cool. That's awesome. Do you plan to invest at all in St. Louis?
I don't think so right now. One of the big things that I have focused on a little bit more, especially as, again, it's kind of like you just jump in and you start learning, and then as that knowledge increases, you make different decisions.
Sure.
So, is newer properties. So, specifically in Charleston, 3 of our properties are less than 3 years old.
Oh, okay.
And the maintenance on those properties is so low.
Sure.
And the other thing that's really neat about the Somerville market is that there's military base around there, mm-hmm. and so that also drives a lot of consistency in long-term tenants. But the focus on low maintenance has really had us focus on newer houses.
Sure.
And in St. Louis, when I'm finding things that would traditionally meet our investment criteria, they tend to be older houses. And so okay. that's, I think, the biggest challenge that we
sure.
have there.
Sure, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, you know, so investing, travel, those are things you're passionate about. I know that you, you know, have worked on a lot of teams. What other things are you passionate about when you were looking for work or when you were looking to find the right place to volunteer?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me is just learning. So that's one thing that I've always been passionate about. I really love school. I like reading. I love to learn from other people. So okay. I love listening to podcasts. I like just anything that I can do to continue to learn. And I think that's probably been the biggest challenge with both staying at home and even to some extent the real estate investment properties. Well, there was definitely a lot of a big learning curve in the beginning, and there's still a little bit of learning going on now. It's a very solid, it can be a very solitary business. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's not a really required interaction besides with the property manager to keep that business going. So, that's a lot of the reason why I started to volunteer besides, you know, finding an opportunity to get back to the community was just wanting to continue to learn new things, continue to grow, meet real interesting people that have different perspectives that sure. can kind of teach me about different things.
Okay.
What type of stuff do you read? Do you read all, like, everything? Or are you, like, for me, I'm like a chronic business/self-help book consumer yeah. or audio book, whatever. I don't read fiction or anything like that, although I think it'd be cool to do that. But, like, what do you read? Do you read everything?
So I read everything. I'd say I'm probably 50-50 on fiction and then business, self-help, financial books. So there's lots of books. I love to read about real estate and investing, again, to just look at different perspectives. And there's always different ways to think about things. I'm reading a book right now that I read before and I wanted to reread, which is called Happy Money, which I think is pretty interesting. And it's just about looking at, there's a lot of studies that say that increased money or increased wealth doesn't make you any happier. But the question is, if you do have an increase in take-home pay, what are the best ways to spend that money that would sure. drive happiness?
Sure.
Yeah. And so I think that's a really interesting book that I read recently.
Is that with... like, and I don't want the cliff notes, nope, so okay. I could probably read it, but, like, is that, like just aligning with whatever your, like, you know, receptors for happiness are? Some people need material things. Some people need to give. Some people need to, I don't know, invest in themselves, yeah. Yeah. you know, whatever it is. Like, is it just basically finding whatever your alignment is, whatever your why is, and then spending that way?
So it's interesting because it's actually fairly prescriptive, and the premise of the book is that there are certain ways to spend your money that would make everybody happy. Now, the interesting thing is it kind of aligns with the way that I, with my internal philosophy, so I think that's maybe why I'm drawn to it. I don't know if someone... sure. that maybe didn't have that same philosophy would feel the same way.
Okay.
Yeah. Because a big premise of the book is spending less on material things and more on experiences. But I don't know, again, am I just looking for something that validates?
Yeah. Are you rationalizing yeah, exactly. the way you think?
Rationalizing.
Well, it doesn't sound like a very selfish.
Yeah.
You know, you could spend your money on an experience or on handbags, but if yeah. you'd prefer to go somewhere where they make handbags, then good for you.
I think that's like the people that have it figured out, right? Spend money on memories and experiences and not yeah. stuff.
Have you, what kind of like self-help or like mindset books or anything like that have you read or listened to that you're into? Or a podcast that you listen to?
Yeah. This is
Besides Welcome to Our World.
I don't know if this is necessarily a self-help book, but one of the books that I read that was also the most interesting in the last couple of years is called, it's called Quiet, The Power of Introverts, like in an extroverted world or something like that. Huh. So I am very much an introvert. And I am very much an introvert. And the company that I worked for when I was working at Red Ventures was it had a very extrovert-focused culture. Mm-hmm. And so that was challenging for me at times to try to figure out how to continue to be successful in that environment, but also just how to maintain my energy levels mm-hmm. in that environment, because that's a big thing if you're introverted and you're spending a lot of time in an extroverted environment. It just can be draining. Yeah. And so I think that book is really interesting because it talks about how just as a culture, we're really focused on the ideal of an extrovert as the charismatic leader. And that's like who everyone should strive to be. Mm. But there's actually, when they look at results from companies and other things, there's just as much success with introverted leaders, even CEOs. They just have a different path of doing things, and it's not what people typically think of it as a leader. So I just think that the book is really interesting, and it just talks about, again, maybe reaffirming.
It sounds like you're really, you're really helping yourself here.
What exactly sounds like me? No. Okay. What kind of things do you struggle with, or what kind of things trip you up?
So I was thinking about this earlier today, and I think the thing that's the most challenging for me right now is I actually really like to work and would really like to be working full time. But one of the things that I have run into in the past, and I'm concerned about running into in the future, is that when I do something, I am all in, probably like 120% in. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to temper myself to 100 or maybe even 90. And so that makes it really challenging for me to find a way that I can realistically balance full-time work with taking care of the kids and the house and everything else, mostly just because I put so much time into my work. So, so I know that's a weird thing to trip me up, but that's one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot, because I'd love to figure out a way that I could rein myself in a little bit and be able to work full-time at a reasonable level.
Sure.
And still have time for other things.
What did you do for Red Ventures when you were with them?
So I did a variety of different things. I started out running their sales operations. They had a really large sales centers. And then ultimately, when I left, I was a general manager. So I ran a specific business, primarily in insurance. But yeah, when I was there, I mean, I would work. And it's partly because the company was growing quickly, and a lot because I can't let go of things. I would work probably, I'd work 9-hour days, then I'd get the kids, bring them home, 2 hours, then they'd be in bed, and then I'd work another 3 hours every night. Yeah. And that's just kind of my speed.
Yeah. I love that speed.
I didn't.
How much
I am
do
now.
You sleep at night?
That's my favorite speed.
Yeah.
I'll probably only live 40 years, but that is my favorite.
That is
speed
your speed,
to run.
Yeah.
So I can relate to that for sure, and I don't think that it's weird or abnormal or anything like that. And if you were a male, it wouldn't be like obtuse at all.
Well,
but
if I was a male, it wouldn't be a married male. It wouldn't be a problem. Because I'd have someone else kind of thinking about a lot of those other things.
Yeah, for sure. But it sounds like
man-hating.
Oh, no, not at all. I super enjoy all of the stuff that I do. And I wouldn't want to trade it for the world. But I'm just saying I do think it is more challenging for a working woman in a household where two people are working.
Yeah. But it sounds like you and Mike are very collaborative and are problem solvers. Like, hey,
definitely.
This is where our life is coming with our family, and this is what's currently going on with our jobs, and we love each other enough that we want this to work so well. What are we going to do to make this happen so that we continue this pace?
And yeah, definitely. And I mean, even when we lived in Charlotte, he used to go into work early, and so that he could then, and then I would go into later, drop off the kids at daycare, then he could come home early, pick up the kids at daycare.
Nice.
And then he would start dinner. And so we just kind of had this rhythm going.
Yeah.
And it worked really well. But it's, I think at some point in time, sometimes, and it's, things just get so busy that they're not sustainable. And then you have to take a break and figure out how to reorganize, do something different. And then I'm sure I'll figure out what that is.
Yeah.
I just don't know what it is yet.
Well, when kids are little and they don't know any different, it's kind of easier to just be like, they're in daycare. Whew, I'm leaving, you know. Mm-hmm. And then when they're older and they have, we were talking about this the other day, they have late start, early dismissal, snow schedule, snow day, what, it's blue day, so they don't go to school today. It's like, oh, okay, great. So
you got to figure that out.
Yeah. Do you, because you've worked in a few different places and they sound more progressive, did the places that you worked have that family mindset of like, okay, you know, the kids are sick today or whatever, or was that you that was like, you know what, if the kids are sick, I you know, because I struggle with that a lot. Like, I still have a job to do. I have to do my job no matter what.
Yeah.
And I'll figure it out.
Yeah. So I will say that where I worked, it was they were super accommodating for things that were family related. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, the job had to get done, be done, which I totally understand.
Yep.
So that may mean, like, if they were sick on a Thursday, I might work most of the day Saturday trying to make up for the work that had to be done.
Sure.
But they were very, very accommodating and flexible. It wasn't certain times that you had to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was helpful.
Going from a very corporate job to being a 1099, I have fear if I ever decided to go back to the corporate world of, like, what do I do if he's sick? Or what do I do if, you know, I'm sick or something like that? Where now I think that because I have the freedom and the respect in my job to where I can come and go as I please, I work harder and I'm there longer than if it was more regimented. So that's a little tangent there, but I don't know. Just felt like saying it out loud.
Just say it out loud. Nobody's listening anyways.
Yeah, it's fine. Okay. Well, what kind of things have you had to turn down to be where you are, where your family is?
And a caveat is not like properties, because I'm sure you've turned down many properties in your investment portfolio.
No,
but like,
plenty.
From a high level,
yeah.
What type of stuff along the way have you just been like, okay, I can't do that because this opportunity is here, or the potential for an opportunity is here, or
and it could be a positive, or it could be something that's like, man,
wish I would have done that.
I really had to turn that one down.
I think the one that stands out the most in my mind was when I, right after I had Caroline, I was working at an insurance company, and I don't know why I had it in my mind. I think it was because my boss, who was much older, had told me he was a vice president at 29. And so I had it in my mind, like, that was a goal of mine, to become a vice president at 29. I don't think for any other reason than he did it.
Sure.
And so I had Caroline when I was 27, and I went back to work for a year, and I ended up, I worked pretty far away from home, so I ended up going back on a reduced schedule. I did that for about 6 months, and they came to me and they said, we really want you to come back full time, and we want to make you a vice president. And I,
you're 28.
I was 28. Yeah, exactly.
In your face.
I know. I would have been ahead of goal. And I just remember thinking about it, really not even very long, and knowing that I just couldn't do it because it wasn't the right thing for our family. And so so I ended up turning it down and just continued to work part-time for a while, and then ultimately ended up opening my own business to provide more flexibility. But I think that's one of the things when I look back and say something that I had to turn down that stands out in my mind, just because it was hard, because I think it was the first time I had to turn something down because of family stuff. But I don't regret it, like, at all.
When you opened your own business, did you name yourself vice president? That would have been the first thing I did.
I didn't even think of it, but there you go.
So I have a quick off spin of that question. You mentioned that you had this goal, an arbitrary goal at best, of being vice president at 29. Have you always been a goal setter? Or in your adult life, is that something that kind of developed? And regardless of if it's new or old, like, how do you set goals now? Like, what's your strategy? Because I try to set goals and I'm like, do I do it monetarily? Do I do it from a happiness perspective? Is it a mental health thing?
Yeah.
Is it a unit thing in our business? Is it a income? How do you set goals? Like, what's your strategy, and is it something that you even think that much about?
I do think about it, and I have always been a goal setter. I was I used to run cross country when I was in high school, and really, that's a sport where you're mostly competitive against yourself, and so constantly setting goals for improving your times. And I've always set goals around a variety of other things. I think the time when I've moved away from that the most is since I've had a family. So it's interesting that you bring that piece into it, because the once I set a goal, I'm so focused on achieving that goal that I can let other things fall by the wayside. And so I think it's really important to I don't even know what it is, maybe like set boundaries and only set goals that fit within
those guardrails.
The guardrails of what's most important. So again, like, if family is the most important to me, and then meeting the goal of vice president, then it doesn't fit in that situation. I was closer to work, a lot of different other situations that may have worked, but in that situation it didn't fit within the guardrails, and so it's just kind of having to change those goals.
So how do you deal with, like, the internal struggle of saying, like, okay, like, I've known you for 37 minutes now, and, like, getting your vibe of, like, I'll run through a wall to achieve whatever I need to. If this is what I set out, you know, I worked 9 hours, then kids for 4 hours, and then another 3 hours, and then I slept for 2 hours, and I got up and did push-ups, like, whatever the insanity is that you're doing. I love it. I dig it. But, like, how do you pull that back and say, okay, I'm going to set goals within my guardrails, knowing damn well that your mind is outside of those guardrails saying, I can do this, I can do this, I can do that. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you keep yourself so well inside those guardrails? It's something I struggle with personally. And I mean, I want to set big goals, but I don't want to set goals so big that, like, at the expense of other things. And it's a fine line for people that want to push the envelope. So how do you deal with that struggle? I'm getting deep.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, I think it's honestly the biggest challenge for me since I stepped away from a full-time career. So I think part of it is the investment property business. I can set goals around that. And so that's something that doesn't take a ton of my time, but I feel like that's achievable. And I think part of it too is looking at things, and this is a mindset that I've come at more recently, is looking at things as more long-term. So it's a little bit different, or at least for me now, it's different because my kids are getting older. So my daughters are 11 and 13. So when I look at when they go away to college, that's really only 7 years away.
Yeah.
And 7 years sounds like a long time, but it's not really a long time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so part of what I've tried to think about now is what can I do to lay the groundwork for things that I may or may not want to do once they're out of the house. And it may not be when they're out of the house. It might be once they're 16 and have cars. So just as time frees up, what are the things that I can do to lay the groundwork? And that's how I've tried to maybe rework my thinking, I guess, is setting longer targets on those goals so that I still have something that I can work towards, but that I'm not doing it 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
So you're not changing the goal, you're changing the time frame.
Yes.
I've heard that before.
Don't change the goal.
Yeah. So would you say there have been any defining moments that have made you who you are, or that have shaped you into what you want to achieve in your life?
Yes. I think one of the things, I don't know if it's a defining moment, but it's definitely something I guess it is a defining moment. It's something that I think back on that really changed my perspective on things. Is so when I was a freshman, I was accepted to MIT, and I spent my first year of school at MIT. My first semester, I failed 3 out of 4 classes. It was a lot harder than high school.
Who'd have thunk it? Yeah. MIT?
Right, I know.
Wow.
And so my second semester, I kind of pulled the philosophy that we talked about and worked a ton. I probably spent 60 to 70 hours going to school and studying. Got straight B's, so I didn't fail, so that's good.
There you go.
And at the end of that semester, I decided to leave MIT and ended up ultimately going to St. Louis University to finish my undergrad. And at the time, people thought it was absolutely, like, the worst
Crazy.
Decision ever, awful, terrible decision, that I was ruining my life. And I think a couple things that I learned coming out of that. One is you have to do what works for you. And, like, I was so miserable and unhappy. It wasn't the right fit for me. And I maybe could have stayed for the full 4 years, but I wouldn't have enjoyed my college experience at all. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is that I went to undergrad at SLU. I ended up going to get my MBA at WashU, and I, through a variety of different roles and opportunities, I got to a place where I considered myself fairly successful and realized I hadn't ruined my life. So,
which is crazy that going from MIT to SLU to WashU, they're like, come on.
Do you think that it was just because was just of the name?
Yes, yeah. I do. I think people are super preoccupied with the names of schools, and I don't know. For me, I feel much different when I talk about our daughters going to school. It was a very stressful, not productive environment from my perspective. But I think it taught me that if you fail at something, you know, you can always recover from it. It's just what you learn from it. But I think the other thing it taught me, which is kind of what we were talking about just recently, is there's alternative paths to everything. So while my path may not have been as direct as if I had gone through straight through MIT, I still ultimately got to where I wanted to get to in my career. And I definitely enjoyed the experience more and probably learned more along the way.
And probably needed whatever you learned in each segment.
Exactly.
In this example, it's going from MIT to SLU to WashU. Like, you needed that. Whatever happened during those transitions, you needed them in order to get to where you wanted to be.
Exactly.
As opposed to stay the course, don't say much, keep your head down.
Just to say that you graduated from MIT.
Yeah.
Well, and there's so much emphasis on the straight and narrow when, you know, there are so many other, if you're happy doing the job that you do and it didn't take you to the Ivy League, like, well, you're going to have a lot less debt, first of all.
Right.
Right. And there's so many paths to get places. Yeah. I mean, if someone is really dead set on a certain college and they don't get in, you can always go to community college for a couple of years and reapply. Like, just always thinking about, you just don't have to take the straight path to your goal. There's a variety of different ways.
I think the goal or the way to navigate that is to be the type of person that you explained yourself to be in the first 5 minutes of talking, which is learning-based. Mm-hmm. You're like, I like to learn. Like that's it. That's all you really have to be, is a learning-based person in order to...
Yeah, you can learn anywhere.
In order to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's be an engineer or a mechanic or a realtor or a scientist. Like, if you're learning-based... Mm-hmm. If you do something long enough for enough repetitions and you're genuine about it and interested, you're probably going to be okay at it.
Right.
And
yeah.
So I think you start there and let the kind of figure out what you want to do and your why and why you do it. And maybe you'll make something yourself.
Maybe.
I don't know.
It's up to you.
When you were talking about that, though, it did remind me, one of the biggest things that I learned at Red Ventures, especially because they were really focused on it, that has definitely helped me in my career, is around receptivity to feedback. So while I feel like I've always been learning-based, I have to say in my younger, very confident years was a little bit less receptive to feedback.
Okay.
And so that's one of the things that as I learned more about how important it is to be receptive to feedback, and also was in an environment where I was provided a lot of really direct feedback, that when you look at my growth from a career trajectory, that growth started to really become exponential once I was in an environment where I was both getting the feedback and then also willing to accept it and implement it.
A high level of accountability both from someone and internally. Wow, that's like a defining moment. Like, I'm waiting for that moment. When does the accountability really make me do what I can do?
It won't. You will. Yeah. You have to.
Well, what choice do I have? I have to edit something at some point.
You just have stockpiles of podcasts in your
computer. The apocalypse is going to happen, and someone's going to find an unreleased podcast, 30 episodes. It's going to be great.
Oh.
All right. Well, top three favorite movies. I'm going to just shift.
Oh, goodness.
They don't have to be, like, in order.
Adams
is
toy soldiers, so relax.
It's one of them.
It's okay.
I'm so not a movie
person. So the bar is pretty high.
Oh, this
You're
is
not?
Gonna be tricky. No, I'm not a movie person.
At all?
Like, I mean, I've watched them. I have watched
How many movies
before.
Have you seen in your life, would you say? Multiple?
What? Oh, yeah. I mean, I've seen multiple.
You're just not a quarter of movies. Like,
what are you a TV show?
I'm not a rewatcher of movies. When I lived over, I think this is the only thing I can account for it is when I lived overseas for all those years, there was no TV for any of that time.
And you lived for 5 years?
Yeah.
That's...
Well, and that was before, like, the internet.
Yeah.
So you couldn't live stream.
There wasn't. Yeah, no TV, no internet, nothing. So, but let me see. I mean, I don't even know.
So you're a book reader. Just do top three books. I can get down with that.
Okay, I think that's a good...
Yeah.
This is more of a cerebral podcast episode so we could go with top three books.
I'll try top three movies. They might be embarrassing. I'm trying to think.
That's okay.
Did you hear what she said? Toy Soldiers is number one for me.
So,
and that stars Lou Gossett Jr.
One of the only movies I've rewatched multiple times, and because my kids like it too, is Legally Blonde.
Okay.
That's fun.
That's
the
best first
one. I do
one
like
ever
that
heard.
One. Let's see. This is killing me. Watched something recently that I really liked on an airplane, and now I can't remember what it was.
Was it Bird Box?
I haven't seen that.
That's not a movie.
We could shift. What?
Is that a show?
No, it's a movie.
Oh.
Sandra Bullock.
I know what it is.
Okay.
I've never seen it.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I should say this movie, but...
Is it a porn?
No.
You can
I don't
for
know.
Sure
it's,
say
it's not my favorite movie. Well, it just be... it's... A movie that's important to me,
okay.
I guess I would
there you
say.
Go.
Yeah. So Matt Shepard is a friend of mine.
Okay.
So
Seen
Matt
it.
Shepard is or was a friend of mine from boarding school. And he was, this is not making it light at all, but he was.
Don't worry about the heaviness of it because
okay.
that's a big part of what we
yeah.
are about. So.
Yeah.
So he was killed in a hate crime in Wyoming over 20 years ago.
Okay.
And so it was one of really the first publicized hate crimes against someone in the gay community. And so since then, his parents have been huge LGBTQ advocates and have done a ton for LGBTQ rights. And so a friend of mine, Michelle, the same one that we went out the window.
The one
together.
Who climbed out the bedroom.
Yeah, they climbed out
the
bedroom window. Yeah. So she went to school for film editing and directing, and she actually spent 5 years putting together a documentary based on Matt, his life, and the impact of the crime and the impact on the nation. And it's called Matt Shepard is a Friend of Mine, and it is actually a really good documentary.
And where can we find that?
So it used to be on Netflix, but it's not anymore. I feel like it's
iTunes?
On. I feel like it's on Amazon or iTunes.
Okay.
I should know, but
okay.
it is good.
Wow.
And you were also in that documentary.
I was. Yes.
I'd like to say it was great.
I shouldn't laugh. It's very serious content. It just makes me feel awkward. I definitely do not like to be in the spotlight, and it took me a long time to agree to be in the movie, but I think the main purpose of the movie is for educational purposes for a lot of younger people that weren't around and didn't understand what happened during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's ultimately why I decided to do it. But
sure.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
I actually watched it because I was interested in it. And I was just sitting there and I said, "Oh my God, Michael, come in the room. Kate is on TV." And he's like, "What are you talking about?" I was like, "What?" I wasn't expecting it,
yes.
You know? I probably would have watched it for other reasons, but it was amazing.
Oh,
it was really good.
She did a really good job.
Yeah, for sure.
So what, and I'm just curious from a personal standpoint,
how
did that impact you? Like, obviously Matthew Shepard's death was national news, and
right.
Like you said, the first example of...
Yeah, the first thing we ever heard
that happening.
In the Midwest.
I mean, we were,
right, sure.
I think we were in eighth grade, or I was in
probably
eighth grade,
mm-hmm,
or freshman year when that happened. So the impact for me was like, what's that mean? You know what I mean? It was so new. It was something you never heard of. It's not today's news cycle, but like being in that circle or that being a personal thing and not a consumer thing, like how did that impact you? And like, your life and how you change your outlook on I mean, I assume that was a huge moment for you.
It was. It was a really, I feel like it's, I don't want to say I grew up in that moment, but to a certain extent, because I think I was 20 when it happened. And I just didn't realize there was such hate in the world. Mm. And not only through the crime that happened to him, but also a group of us went up to Wyoming for his funeral. And there were bomb threats at the funeral. There were protesters at the funeral, which
sure.
is something that, I mean, it's hard to even imagine how someone could protest a funeral.
Yeah.
And just that level of hate in the world was just really sad to see, and that was my first exposure to it. And so I don't know, I think it was a moment where you just you lose some of your naivety about
yeah.
the world, yeah,
and maybe
yeah.
your faith in humanity a little bit,
maybe, although I still have a lot of faith in humanity. I think that we just need to be doing everything that we can to teach people to be more open-minded. I mean,
yeah.
I feel
yeah.
like, you know, the work that Matt's parents do is amazing through their organization. And then just everyone individually, as much as they can help their children, the children
yeah.
that are, you know, within the circle of influence
sure.
that they have, just help understand how to be accepting of other people, really, regardless. I mean... There's so many different types of hate. It's just
yeah.
Removing all of that and just being accepting of
yeah.
all the different people, everybody. So I think it's more that it makes me feel like that's really important than losing my faith in humanity.
Well
and there,
I don't mean to have a dark outlook
yeah.
on it, but like in my mind, if we talk, how often do we talk about the pendulum of like
yeah.
life? So like like you said, it was the first time you realized there was that much hate in the world. Did you also see the same examples of like the support and love? Like you didn't know that it could be that accepted in a public setting as a, I mean, when,
right.
when you're internal, it's your small circle. I assume that that's just what you know, but you understand that there's people that don't accept that. And then when something like of national notoriety happens like this, I assume that there's just a ton of support and additional stories, and being inside of that has to be pretty powerful too, to know that the
definitely
other swing.
Yeah, there was and I can't think of the name of them right now. I mean, just even when you talk about what was physically happening outside of the funeral, there were protesters, but then there was a group of people that created angel wings. And so they made really tall angel wings, and they all stood
and blocked
the protesters, between the protesters and the funeral space, so the family could grieve in private. And those
yeah.
were all people, you know,
yeah.
that didn't know Matt. So that's a really, you know, impressive testament to.
Heck yeah, it is.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So what, if anyone was interested in what Matt's family does continually, the gala, things mm-hmm. like that, what is their impact today in this world, and what kind of things do they do that someone could, investigate and get involved with?
So the majority of what they do is really, they go and speak both nationally and internationally. They went and spoke in Russia a couple of years ago, which was really bold.
Yeah.
And they also work with policymakers. So they were, they worked with Obama on the Matt Shepard, James Byrd Hate Crime Act, I think it is. And they do a lot of work with the FBI and local organizations to help categorize more crimes as hate crimes and also be able to report on them, because if a crime isn't categorized as a hate crime, it's easy to say that hate crimes are down. So sure. They're doing a lot of work to help just better understand that, so that once we can better understand the size of the problem to help address it. The biggest way to help is just through donations to the Matthew Shepard Foundation, because that supports all of the work that they do. They're a super grassroots organization. There's only, I think they have 3 or 4 full-time employees, and then the Shepherds just donate their time to go around speaking. It's amazing to see what impact they've had in such, over the last 20 years, just from going out and telling their story, because it is so, I think what people connected with Matt was he was just such a relatable person, and people felt like that could be my son or that could be my daughter.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Okay. Well, since you love accountability so much, I'm going to hold you accountable. That's 2 out of 3.
I know,
movies.
I was just thinking.
So we have Legally Blonde.
Yes.
Matthew Shepard is a friend of mine.
It's quite the eclectic.
That's
mix.
Okay. If you can manage to give us a Toy Soldier reference,
it's
for your
okay
third.
Because you're going to reach such a wide spectrum of audience at this point with that list.
Yeah.
You could give
anything.
It's a Wonderful Life and just really round it out.
All right, so if we're going to talk about movies that I've watched multiple times, which I feel like is kind of a favorite, you said It's a Wonderful Life. It's not that. It's Elf.
Oh,
Elf
yes.
is a family favorite.
That's a good
so,
one.
Yeah, we, at my request, break that out every Christmas. And
okay.
So, yeah.
That's a fantastic list. I really like how dynamic you are. Awesome. Well, Kate, I feel like as a family, we pretty much do the same thing at every gathering. We eat the same food. Yeah. We have the same conversation. So it personally was great to get to know you more. And I really appreciate the fact that you agreed to, be a little vulnerable with us. And really glad that you came out tonight.
Well,
so.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. It was a lot of fun chatting, and it's a beautiful night in a beautiful backyard. So
thank you.
Can't get much better than this.
Yeah. No, awesome. This has been awesome.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks, guys.
All right. Oh, are you still there?
They're still here.
That's crazy. Well, if you can't get enough of us, follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Welcome to Our World.
And thanks for listening. And if you listen on Spotify or iTunes, it'd be pretty cool if you gave us a rating.
And tell your friends.
All right.
Thanks.